The following is a Felt Nowt production. To find out more, visit feltnowt.co.uk.
Welcome to What's It Like, brand new podcast from me, Lee Kyle. I am a stand-up comedian, and in this I will be interviewing people who do things very different to what I do about one very specific part of their life and asking what's it like. Today I feel I very much have to have a content warning because I'm asking my friend Dawn Bowman what it's like to work on the helplines for Rape Crisis, which she does. She works for Rape Crisis Tyneside in Northumberland. And first off, obviously, if that's something you just don't want to listen to because it's going to affect you negatively, I totally understand. But just know that we have dealt with this sensitively. We haven't gone in this being salacious. We haven't revealed details of any cases. Obviously, we wouldn't do that both morally and legally. That hasn't happened. It's more about how Dawn works in that sector. How it felt taking her first call, how she can relax after that. It's a very fascinating chat. She's a lovely person. I've known Dawn since I was a teenager. She does great work. And I'd love you to give it a listen, but of course, if you think that is too heavy for you, we do have other episodes coming up. Now, join our Patreon. We've got a Patreon, not just for this show. We've got patreon.com/feltnowt. That's Feltnowt, which is a collective of comedians all over the northeast of England. Every penny that we make goes back into creating more comedy, putting more gigs on. And if you've heard this on our regular podcast feed, just know that you can get this earlier. You could have got this earlier on the Feltnowt Patreon. Not only that, but there is a bonus episode on there, 15 to 20 minutes long, of extra conversation with Dawn, which is very interesting and has a surprise twist at the end, which neither of us saw coming. What's the point of joining our Patreon? There's loads of point. First off, we have so many goals to get out of this. What we want eventually is a full-time comedy club run by us for comedians in the Northeast and comedy fans in the Northeast, which we want you to be part of. We don't just want to be you give us money, we give us stuff. We want this to be a team effort. We want you to come to our gigs and feel it's a home that you never knew you had. We also are going to give you loads of stuff. So for as little as £5 per month, you are getting exclusive podcast content. But that's not all. You get access to Nowtflix, which is our video on demand service with hours and hours of full-length stand-up shows from comedians in the Northeast that you can't see anywhere else. New ones added all the time. We've got a backlog. They're all going to be getting added in the next few months. For £10, there's extra things. If you pay £10 a month, we can give you things like online quizzes, gig tickets. I mean, if anyone out there fancies paying £50 a month, we've got some ridiculous offers there too. But even for as little as £3 a month, you can join and become a member of the Felt Nowt Club. What does that mean, Lee? Well, first off, there's going to be prize draws and surprises. But everybody who signs up to our Patreon, whether £3, £5, £10, or the magic long shot of £50, joins the Felt Nowt Club. You get an online membership card sent straight to you. You find out the secret password. Do you remember, like, Dennis the Menace fan club? Yeah, like that, but for adults. That made it sound seedy. I don't mean like adult, just it's for adults. A secret password, surely, that sounds great. Who wouldn't want that? But is there a secret handshake? Yes. So for as little as £3 a month, you can join our club, secret handshake, password, membership card, and loads of surprises. But chuck a bit more in. Get Nowtflix, get podcasts, get live gig tickets, get loads. But most of all, for now, enjoy this podcast, what I think is a genuinely interesting interview with the wonderful Dawn Bowman. Hello, Dawn.
Hello, Lee.
You are Dawn Bowman.
I am
correct?
Dawn Bowman, Yes, that's me.
Who I've known for many years, and I'm about to have possibly our first ever sensible conversation. Because you have a very responsible job, for which you have to have the pretense of being a real person.
I do have to pretend a lot.
And actually, you are very kind and caring and thorough, right? But I also know that you're an idiot. So well done for fighting against your impulses to do actual good work on behalf of other people.
Thank you.
So done. What's it like, right, working on a rape crisis? Would you say hotline? Is that makes it sound too much like pop, like something you drink to find out who's in the top 40?
Yeah, it's not a hotline.
It's not a hotline. That's not right, is it?
No, it's a helpline.
Helpline. That is more useful.
Yeah.
Isn't it? So you used to work on the helpline more than you do now.
Well, now I manage the helpline.
Hello.
That's right. But I started as a volunteer on the helpline, and then when we didn't have lots of volunteers, I used to do a lot of answering the calls myself. But now we have a really big group of volunteers, so I do a lot of the management and coordination.
So you started as a volunteer?
Yes.
Had you worked in stuff similar to that before? Because that is a lot. That is a big jump from most things you would do.
Yeah, so I was a youth worker, a community youth worker. And so when you're a youth worker, young people tell you stuff anyway, because that's kind of part of your role. So okay. Young people are, I would be taking young people away on trips, or we'd be doing work together and planning events and things like that. But, you know, while you're washing the dishes together or chatting, then young people tell you about their lives. So interestingly, actually, just to go really serious really quickly.
It's meant to.
Interestingly, the young women who were experiencing sexual exploitation in Rotherham, youth workers were some of the first people they told about what they'd experienced. And it was the youth workers who were flagging problems that weren't acted on as quickly as they could have been.
Okay, that makes sense, because I guess you're to these people, you are an adult, but you're an adult who is quite often being silly with them and sort of, I don't want to say talk to them on their level, hi kids, but you know what I mean? You are able to, you're not an authority figure in the same way, I guess. You're not a school teacher, you're not a parent.
No, a youth worker is somebody who's kind of bridging that gap. So you're being in a more informal space with them. So even when I was doing youth work, I was hearing about kind of experiences young women maybe were having around violence, and then, you know, and I'm a feminist, so like I wanted to do some volunteer work in a feminist space, and Rape Crisis is about approaching sexual violence from a feminist analysis, approaching the work from that point of view.
Okay, without me, obviously I know, so I'm not going into this, just for anybody else who doesn't know, How what do you mean by a feminist analysis of it from a feminist perspective? Like, sure, I know that what you work with women.
Yeah.
I get that, but what other sort of analysis is there?
So, so we work with women, including trans women, and non-binary people who identify that women's services are right for them. So that's our clear message on who we're for. It doesn't mean that we don't think that men and boys experience sexual violence, because they do, but what we know is that women and girls are much more likely to experience sexual violence than men and boys.
Yeah.
And our feminist analysis tells us that sexual violence happens because of the oppression of women, and that also women are controlled by the fear and threat of sexual violence as well. So women's general lives are impacted, and just the way we navigate the world is impacted by sexual violence. And also women are subject to rape culture in a way that men and boys aren't.
Okay, so for example, as a man, I don't think I've experienced any sexual, that's not true, I have. Oh, yes, I have. I remember I was another comedian once on stage who I'd never met, kept kissing my neck in front of loads of children, and that when I was asking him to stop, but I didn't. There was loads of children there, so I had to pretend it was fun, and it wasn't. Mm-hmm. But the fact is, I didn't think about that immediately.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm not saying it can't affect my life, but I suppose one of the differences there's not the ever-present threat there. I don't have to think about where I'm going to go, say.
No, and I think that ever-present threat is really interesting when you think about the safety work that women and girls do. So I do a lot of work with people who work in the nighttime economy through our Shout Up campaign, and that's my cat playing with a ball in the background.
Feminists love cats. I don't want to be... I know it sounds like a cliche, but...
It's true.
That's maths.
We do a thing called the Shout Up campaign, and we work with... should we just move
no,
the
no,
cat?
I think people are enjoying the cat. It's adding a bit of levity, isn't it?
Yes.
Like, you can be thinking about some frankly horrific subject matter, but look, a cat's playing with a toy.
So that's why we have cats as feminists. We tend to do really
as feminists, that's
jobs.
Why I have cats.
Yeah. I speak on behalf of all feminists.
As a feminist that. Who is also a man, I have two cats and three guinea pigs. So who's the better feminist, really?
Obviously you.
Yeah. It's not a competition, but I've won. Sure, she does great work, you know, for Rape Crisis, but I've got three guinea pigs, so...
Definitely. I think maybe guinea pigs might be the new cat.
They do shit a lot.
Do they?
Yeah, but let's not go on to guinea pigs now. I think we're on a more
important
topic.
We're talking about safety work, so...
So before you go, nighttime economy, is that sort of people who work in bars or...?
Yeah, so like pubs, clubs and bars, really. So we run Shout Up in Newcastle with lots of venues in Newcastle who get on board with Shout Up to... sign up to say that they will take a zero tolerance approach to sexual harassment. And part of the conversations that we have with the people who are working in bars is about the level of safety work women do while they're out on a night out and how it's different to men. And we all have to be responsible for our own safety. Of course we do, but women do much more safety work than men. So things like texting each other when they get home, you know, like going to each other's house to get ready so that everyone gets a taxi back to the same place, you know, watching each other's drinks.
I see, that's something I've never thought of. Like, as somebody who, like, as you know, like, I would say more of my friends are women than men, but it's still not the same as being one.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there is still an assumption, I think, among men that or women like to get ready together, or they like to go to the toilet together, and it's because it's just, oh, they're having a lot of fun there. And that it may be the case, but I've never really thought of the fact that it is safer to go together.
Yeah, it is safer to go. And, you know, don't get me wrong, some of the best times I've ever had in my life are, you know,
in
getting ready.
Toilets.
Yeah, in women's toilets. That sounds awful. But it's true, you know, like going together to somebody's house and getting ready together and, you know, having drinks together before you go out. And that's all part of the fun of a night time. A night out. But and being in the toilets, chatting and, you know, telling each other you look beautiful and, you know, helping the crying girl in the toilet and all of that. It's all part of the night out. But we also, it's also part of our safety work.
Yeah. So, like, when I think of things you have to do, it's something I've tried to become more aware of, I guess, but from the outside, because there's things you don't think, the only things I've ever had to do, say, is you'll occasionally, as a man, have to take a different route home. But that is, as a woman, that is just a constant thought, you know, and there's things like, I've tried to, and I've seen some men complain about this, I've tried to make a point of crossing a road on a night when there's been a woman on it, and I've seen men go, oh, well, I'm not going to do anything, what should be an unreasonable for? And you go, well, yeah, but they don't know that.
No,
and I don't know why you wouldn't take that step.
Yeah, it's about being taught it, and actually one of the pieces of safety work that we used to do together, actually, we have known each other for a long time.
Both quite old now.
Very old now. So Lee used to walk me home. We used to hang around about a mile away from
my
house.
This was when we were teenagers.
Yeah, so when we were teenagers, Lee would walk me home and then have to walk home back from his... So he would walk past his house to walk me home to make sure I got home safely.
Oh, God, that makes me sound much nicer than
You're
I am.
You're such a nice boy.
Didn't even try to have it off for you or anything.
Didn't try to have it off with us. And actually, you were far... You know, you experienced more violence on the streets than I did.
Yes.
As teenagers.
I think, in terms of actual non-sexual violence...
Yeah.
My instinct is to say men get more than that, but at a specific age.
Yeah.
So my worries on the streets now are very low at my age. I'm a man of 42. I'm sort of invisible to the people who are looking for fights, almost. But it is certainly where I'm from. We're from Jarrow in South Tyneside. It's known as the town that was murdered, in that when they shut down the shipyards, they put deeds in place to say not only are the shipyards shut down, but you're not allowed to open new ones for 30 years, and the whole town was killed, and then they did the same with the mines. So it's a place of massive deprivation, and there is definitely, I like the place, but let's not pretend there's not a violent edge to it. And as a young man, certainly from the ages of about 10 to 25, it is scary to walk around. That's the time when I think I was most careful. There's always the chance in this sort of town, especially, I don't say looking like I look, but being like I am, which is a fairly feminine camp man, right? There is definitely an air of potential violence.
But it
doesn't pervade my life now.
No.
Like it would a woman's of any age.
Yeah, so, you know, what we experienced when we were younger, like you were walking me home and you were attacked and beaten up. And still, after that, you still would walk me home. Because still we're taught in society that I'm the one that needs to be protected. And that message has stayed with me all my life.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
So I still wouldn't, you know, the other day I was going to take my dogs for a walk. And I was like, oh, I best go now because it's going to get dark and I want to walk through the park. And I won't walk through my local park alone at night, even though I've got two dogs with me. And that kind of fear of sexual violence is ever present for lots of women, whether we consciously know it or not. Like lots of things, like, you know, like I said before, text me when I get home or phoning somebody on the way home. You know, sharing our location with friends,
yeah.
You know, lots of things like getting taxis that we don't need to get. We're just like more likely to get taxis for short journeys because that's
interesting when you say how aware you are. Like in my head, I did used to walk you home, but I don't ever think I purposely realised I was doing it for safety reasons. I was doing it because my friend is on her own, lives a bit further than me. It's quite nice to talk to her as well. I'm in no rush to get home. There was part of that. But looking at from a perspective of someone who is no longer a teenager, clearly that's a part of it.
Of course it was. And if I hadn't, and it was also like, if you didn't walk me home, then I would have either had to walk home or leave at a certain time to get a certain bus to get, and then there would be a walk from the bus.
And the absolute truth is, if one of my male friends had lived where you lived and you hadn't, I wouldn't have walked with him.
No.
That's just true, isn't it? That's
But also, like, in fairness, that was also when we got to chat and have nice times as well, that, you know, that nice sharing bit where you were able to be your sensitive self.
That, okay, I'm going to say, I think that is probably what makes you suitable for the job you do, in that there was nobody else I would have talked to about, you know, those feelings or thoughts you have when you're a teenager,
mm-hmm.
who I knew other than you. Like, why was it you? You know what I mean? Like, I had other friends who, in some ways, I was closer to, I spent more time with, but you were probably the one I valued most, certainly in that way, right? Do you think, when you volunteered at first, before this was your job, were you aware that that's the sort of person you are?
I've always been aware that people feel able to tell me things and maybe feel safe to tell me things, and that I can hold a space for that. And that's what the helpline is. It's about holding a space for somebody who is telling you about their sometimes deepest feelings of pain and trauma, and about things that maybe they've never told anyone else about. And so I've always been aware that people have shared with things with me in the past and throughout my life. That's been a privilege of my life, actually, to be in that position of trust. And it's something that I've been aware of.
So you've always known it. Is it ever a burden? Like, when I look at it, you're like a couple of years younger than me, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of part of me can go, how dare I, as a teenager, unburden any problems I have on a friend of mine who actually is younger than me, and that way has less life experiences. Like, is it a burden that you're someone who people come to with their problems?
Not really, no, because, you know, I'm not without people who hold that space for me as well. Like, I'm very, very lucky to have amazing friends who, when I need to talk about how I'm feeling, will hold that space. And I think, Lee, you were doing that for me as well when we were teenagers. But my problems were probably a lot more boy-focused, which is ludicrous.
Ironic now. Because yeah. You would think, to look at were, I don't want to judge, but you would think mine would have been a lot more boy-focused than yours.
You would think that, yeah. But I am, I'm the member of the LGBTQ community and you're not.
Weirdly, I'm not, and it doesn't make any sense. I'm just a very sensitive boy.
Yeah.
Who loves... I'm going to leave... Cut that there. So your first... What we're not going to do here, everybody, I think you probably got this vibe. What we're not going to do is tell any stories about things people have rang you with. First off, we wouldn't. Secondly, I reckon there's legal issues. But we're not going to anyway, for whatever reason, if that's what you want. I'm hoping there's not a podcast out there for you anyway. So, but how does it feel the first day you're there, right? Without... You're sat at a phone. It's never happened before. Someone's going to phone you to tell you about the worst thing that's ever happened to them. Before it ever happens, how does that feel?
I think the first thing I would say is just to offer reassurance that Rape Crisis Helpline volunteers, by the time they're sat at a phone waiting for the phone to ring, will have had lots of training and done lots of kind of simulated situations. Okay. So, but it's scary, and it doesn't not be scary, you know, waiting for that phone to ring and knowing that somebody is going to potentially be extremely upset and you be responsible for holding that space. It can be scary and daunting. So the first time I was scared and worried that I was going to say something terrible to make the person feel worse, to make that woman feel worse.
Because you are still a flawed human who that can have. You can have all of the training, but you're still a human, and also you can't. Training can't give you the answer to every potential problem. No, there's no way.
It can't, and so you have to. You have to just react to what the person's bringing on the phone, and so it's never a scripted response. It's always you. You know, your training is about kind of understanding the boundaries of the service, what the service can offer, and also developing your skills and knowledge so that you're able to respond to that person in the moment. Because the key bit of the helpline is that, you know, it's person-centred is what we call it, or woman-centred. And so we respond to what that person's bringing. Yeah, so it is scary. It can be scary and daunting.
How do you feel? So what sort of, in terms of time, if you are on the phones, how long is the stretch that you'd be taking phone calls for? Like, is it something that sometimes you do all day? Or is it a thing where you go, you can do a couple of hours of this, but then you need a break?
Yeah, so helpline shifts are 2.5 to 3 hours long. And phone calls are 50 minutes long. So it's called the therapeutic hour. So it's 50 minutes. And that's how long we'll stay on the phone with somebody. Unless there's a reason that we need to stay on longer. Yeah. Like, you know, there's a safeguarding issue that we need to continue to support somebody around. But usually it's up to 50 minutes.
Okay.
And that's usually... But that's not just about how long we can listen for and hold that concentration. That's about how long somebody can really kind of stay engaged and talking about their feelings for.
So that's sort of... I don't know how closely linked this is, but that's sort of the length of time they now recommend for lessons in school.
Yeah.
Say, like, people can only stay engaged so long.
Yeah.
And it's absolutely why, our long Edinburgh shows, they dip. You know, but it's sort of true, isn't it? It's sort of true that people can focus for so long and you do get antsy, you know. And so you've had that amount of time, so you're on a... How do you feel after that length of time? Like, is it... Obviously, it's going to be different every day because you have different calls, but... Do you have after that, do you maybe have to decompress, or are you able to sort of compartmentalise?
So when we end especially a long call, like usually, you know, you might have a cup of tea, you'll talk to the other helpline women who are in the room, not about the details of the call, but how you're feeling, and, you know, take a moment and... You know, you wouldn't certainly not be answering the next time the phone rang because another volunteer will answer. And sometimes, I'm not going to lie, sometimes there are calls that you take home with you emotionally. Yeah, yeah. And sometimes that is enough. Like, it's enough to get some support from the people that you're on with that night, and that's enough. But there's some calls that, you know, I'll come home and I'll need to watch terrible TV because I need to switch my brain off from it.
Are you good at switching your brain off?
Mostly, but not always.
So, are there any times when you will have taken a particularly, I don't want to say harrowing, I don't know if that's the right phrase, but a call that's affected you for in certain ways, where even though you're meant to be on the phone longer, is there sort of an understanding to go, I can't take any more today? Is that a reasonable thing to do, or are you able to just go, no, I'm not allowed to do that, I've got to do this thing because I'm helping people?
Well, we volunteer in groups for a reason, and that's one of the reasons. Like, I wouldn't end a call prematurely because I wasn't able to continue holding that space for the woman, but I've definitely ended calls where I've been like, I can't do any more tonight.
Yeah.
And that's it. And that has to be okay, because I, you know, and this isn't just for me, this is for the other women who volunteer on the helpline. It has to be okay for them to say, that's it, that's emotionally all I can do tonight.
Yeah, because it must be incredibly draining. And also, how can you, I suppose, help the next person as well as you just have?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, I have cried after helpline calls. You know, I have had to do a lot of processing and a lot of work after some calls that I've taken. And what's important, I suppose, for people to know is that we have clinical supervision. So I have a space that I go to with a clinical supervisor who's a therapist,
right,
where I can talk about how what I hear and what I'm managing impacts on me, and our volunteers have that as well. And that's a really important part of safe practice, really.
So is there a time frame for the job? By which I mean, obviously the fact that you have clinical things in place means that there's obviously an awareness that it's a difficult and taxing job mentally.
Mm-hmm.
And often, sometimes in jobs like that, for example, I know police who work with particularly harrowing stuff, like ones who work seizing child pornography and things, tend to only do that for a short period of time because the mind can only take so much of that sort of thing. You know, it's not a fun thing for anyone to see, or anyone who you would like to see. You know, is it a thing where you might go, as much as this job's valuable, as much as I'm glad I do it, is there sometimes you sort of go, I could do with just working in a shop for a bit?
I think, you know, I've definitely had, and that's, you know, that's just about the responsibilities that we carry in jobs like this, that there's sometimes been times where I have wanted to, you know, just work in a shop. But the rewarding part of the job outweighs it, and my passion for my work outweighs that, definitely. And actually, what enables me to keep going is the support from my colleagues, the training that I've got, you know, the clinical supervision that I have.
So does it feel like a genuine team effort?
Yeah, the helpline, definitely. I mean, Rape Crisis, you know, Tyneside and Northumberland, where, you know, we're a team, we've grown massively, and then we're teams within a team as well, within our services, and the helpline definitely feels like a team effort. The helpline volunteers are wonderful. Like, they are absolutely amazing. But also, we're part of this wider movement, which is the Rape Crisis movement.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm on the board of trustees for Rape Crisis England and Wales, so that we can kind of push, and, you know, nationally, to support the provision of rape crisis centres across England and Wales. And I'm working with, you know, sisters in Rape Crisis Scotland and Rape Crisis Network Ireland as well, and to ensure that services are there, and specialist services are provided. And being part of that wider movement's a really important part of my self-care as well.
Yeah. So what do you find, so is the biggest, I don't want to say negative, that's not the phrase I'm looking for, what is the thing you're most fighting against? Is there like a thing in terms of public perception that becomes very frustrating, or is a massive bridge that is not close to being crossed?
for Rape Crisis.
Or yes, or just sort of without, I guess, for just the views of sort of that as a crime in general, or the whole culture around it.
There's many problems. There are so many things that we're fighting against. You know, the need for sustainable long-term funding for Rape Crisis services. And protecting specialist spaces is really key for us. But in terms of the wider issue, the fight for women and girls and anybody who's experienced sexual violence to be believed and to be taken seriously and for what they've experienced to not be minimised. You know, we've been fighting rape culture for decades now, and by we I mean the bigger we of feminists. We've been fighting rape culture and the myths that surround sexual violence and the blame that women and girls often feel when they experience sexual violence, and that is just ever present.
Yeah,
it's ever present in, you know, in society at large, and then when you are supporting somebody who's experienced sexual violence, it's that sense of blame and shame that people experience after experiencing rape and sexual abuse, or even child sexual abuse, carrying blame and shame because of that. It's a massive part of the work that we do.
Yeah, it's a thing to go, how do you move past these things once they've happened to you? Is like, it's the shame, isn't it, when you're like, it's trite for me to say there's no reason to have that shame, and that might be the case, but it doesn't mean that it isn't there.
No, and doing that really careful work to support somebody to unpick that sense of blame and shame is often key to what we're doing with people. So us saying that we believe somebody and they shouldn't feel like what happened was their fault, can only go so far. We have to support them to come to that conclusion themselves, and to have that, you know, that understanding that this wasn't their fault, that someone chose to do this to them.
And it's a strange thing, because I don't know, I may be off on a limb here, but it's like there's two levels of understanding, isn't there? Because I do think most people in their brain know it isn't their fault, but it doesn't mean that you don't also think that it is. Does that make sense? As in, like, our brains aren't always our best friends.
Yeah.
You can be telling yourself one thing while deep down you're thinking another.
Yeah.
That doesn't necessarily work on a logical level. But, again, in the world we're in, we don't always work on a logical level.
No, and we're surrounded by messages all the time that tell us that we have to do our safety work, that if we experience sexual violence, then we must have done something to make that happen, and that we should react in a certain way when that happens. And they're all not true. They're not truths. Like, we don't experience sexual violence because we bring it on ourselves. We experience sexual violence because somebody chooses to hurt you.
Yeah.
That's why we expect to hurt you and to disregard your consent, to, you know, to disregard your wishes. Yeah, and there is, and there's also this myth around how you're supposed to react when you experience sexual violence and how you're supposed to be afterwards.
It was lovely to talk to Dawn, it always is. I'd like to say I hope you enjoyed that. I don't know if enjoyed's really the right term, but I think it's always wonderful to speak to Dawn from my point of view, and I think wonderful to hear her talk. I think Dawn's one of the few people I've met in my life who is just unquestionably a great person. I think my life would have been much different and a great deal worse had I not had her there as a teenager. And then we sort of lost touch for 15, 20 years, and I'm glad we're back. There's plenty more from Dawn, by the way. Sign up to patreon.com/feltnout. There's another about 20 minutes where we carry on the conversation exactly where it stopped. So we talk about what is considered the correct and incorrect response to suffering these horrific crimes, and how
The truth is there is no correct or incorrect response, and the pressure to have the correct response kind of fucks a lot of people up. But there's also a lovely light-hearted bit where I decide that Dawn is queen of the world. So that's quite a twist, isn't it? So patreon.com/feltnout. There's loads of other stuff on there, and this is just the start. There's going to be loads, and loads and loads and loads and loads and loads. Thank you very much, everyone. My name's Lee Kyle. Love you in a way.
That was a Feltnout production. To find out more, visit feltnout.co.uk.